Brian Had a Dream. 10,000 movies, 40 years. This is his journey, and this is your invitation to join along. This is the quest for 10,000.
I'm Ben.
And I'm Brian.
And you are listening to The Quest for 10,000, our audio journey with Brian as he tries to watch 10,000 movies before he turns 40. In this episode, we find multiple versions of ourselves as we talk about multiple versions of Spider-Man as we go into the Spider-Verse with Peter Parker, Miles Morales, Gwen Stacy, and a whole host of other Peter Parkers. We'll also do a top five animated voiceover performances. Before, though, we get to all that, again, we thank you for downloading, listening to this podcast, sharing it with someone else to listen. You can follow us on Twitter at 10K Movies, T-E-N-K Movies, or on Brian's blog, 10kmovies.com. So, Brian, here we are. We know that you were on movie 9,992, and that it was Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. So, like in our last episode with Mary Poppins Returns, let's just start. What were your overall initial impressions of this movie?
Fantastic. I mean, it was a great movie. It was, I loved so many things they did. I loved the different iterations of Spider-Man. You know, when you're talking about a movie that includes Spider-Ham, you are talking about a movie that could run off the rails really quickly.
That's right. We should also mention probably at this point,
depending on how you handle that, that could get really just groan-inducing. But in all the right ways.
We should mention there will be some spoilers for this film as we discuss it. This is a movie both Brian and I were able to see. And so we'll probably go in a little more in-depth than we would on just the film Brian has seen as we talk about this. I agree with you. I loved it. It was amazing because I love Miles Morales. I still read the comics, follow the comics, and I told you, Miles Morales is probably the best character Marvel has created in just years upon years upon years, rivaled maybe only by Gwen Stacy as an alternate universe Spider-Woman.
Not necessarily created in our lifetime, but you're talking about created in the last, like, 15 years, right?
15, 20 years, yeah. I think it really gave people who have read the comics and love Miles, it really entered him now into more of a public consciousness about that. It was just pitch perfect. I've heard some other reviews call it the most comic book of all comic book movies, in other words.
That's certainly true.
The way the animation style and the way it seemed to be shot
was just amazing. I'm not as familiar with comic books or the recent comic books as maybe you are. In the comic book story, does Miles exist in a universe where Peter Parker was Spider-Man?
He does, and
in this movie. Is that true to his origin story in the comics?
Yeah, the Peter Parker in his comic universe originally was also a teenage Peter Parker, not as grown up and advanced the Tobey Maguire version of Spider-Man.
I mean, it wasn't like he was an old man.
Right, but he wasn't the Tobey Maguire married version of Spider-Man.
Well, I mean, he probably was the Tobey Maguire. He wasn't being portrayed as a teenager.
But in the comics, it was a teenage Spider-Man that died fighting the Green Goblin, and Miles got his powers kind of around the same time Peter was fighting the Goblin and then decided to become Spider-Man to kind of fill the void. Now in the comic books, Marvel did sort of a soft reboot of their universe, and now Miles and Peter in the same universe. And that also follows after, there was a time after Miles was a little bit established, there was a limited series called Spider-Man, I think, that inspired some, possibly, of the interactions that we see in this movie with the other universe Peter meeting Miles Morales. But it's called Spider-Man, and so it's like the main Marvel universe coming to the ultimate Marvel universe where Miles is, and they meet each other and interact. But now in the comic continuity, Miles and Peter coexist in the same universe, which is really interesting. But there's also a Spider-Gwen who's in her own universe that's kind of crossed over some, and the idea that there's something kind of maybe flirtatious or romantic possibly between Gwen and Miles is kind of part of it. So it's really exciting to me as someone who's read it, just again to see how faithful they kind of were and how really true to Miles. They kind of put a really nice shine on Miles Morales. And I really enjoyed
now,
that.
Correct me, because I don't know. Is Spider-Ham's Spider-Noir, are those original characters to the movies, or do those exist in the comics?
Spider-Ham came, like, sometime in the mid-80s, I want to say.
Okay.
It was just, you know, Marvel was producing kind of a more younger kids-oriented comics.
And
so they
was
created.
Lots of cocaine involved.
They
sure.
created Peter Porker, the Spectacular Spider-Ham. There was, I think, it was the Incredible Bunny. So it was like a Hulk, but a rabbit. Captain AmeriCat.
Sounds fantastic.
I think Dr. Doom Mouse. Iron Mouse, maybe, or something like
wow.
that. Here's the origin though of Spider-Ham, is that he was a spider bitten by a radioactive pig.
Whoa.
And that's what happened. It's not a takeoff. The Simpsons spider pig probably in some ways an allusion to Spider-Ham rather than the other way around. So Spider-Man Noir was also a Marvel limited series. They came out with several limited series, Wolverine Noir, Spider-Man Noir, some other characters. And then Spider-Gwen and the anime spider character came in a comic storyline in Spider-Man called Spider-Verse.
So none of those provided
the basis for this film.
None of those characters are original to the movie?
No, they are not.
Okay. That's what I was wondering, if they had created any whole cloth.
And the narrative, you know, the idea of Prowler being Miles' uncle, that's also from Miles' origins, very much there. And also that story offering a nice parallel between Peter Parker and his Uncle Ben and Miles.
Since Prowler, and I don't know how the comics handled it, but since Prowler was attacking him, I mean, he was on the other side. It made another layer to that dynamic of the one who inspired me is also, you know, which Uncle Ben never has been able to.
Yeah, I was so impressed by the emotional beats that they hit in so many different ways in this movie. The speech outside Miles' dorm room by his dad, that was just wonderful. You know, I was watching that with my son, who was crying because he was so upset because Miles was down on himself and didn't think that he was going to be okay. And then he hears the speech and then goes. And so my son was just so excited about it, and I was too. It was just, I thought that was amazing. Parts with Lily Tomlin as Aunt May were done really, really well.
Can't go wrong with Lily Tomlin.
You know, one piece maybe we disagree on a little bit as we've talked about this was the depiction of Kingpin, the primary villain. Kind of struck you as a little bit odd, didn't it?
It did. I didn't like the character design. I felt like he looked like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle villain reject and didn't look like a real... Everybody else looked like they belonged or... Now, the characterization of Kingpin, fantastic.
Yeah, Liv Schreiber was really good.
I love that, you know, he was motivated to more or less destroy the world because he was desperately trying to bring his wife and son back. So I love that. And that part nailed it. I loved Catherine Hahn as Doc Ock. I loved the differences between the Spider-Man who died heroically and Spider-Man who let himself go. I thought that was really interesting and good. The voice cast in general from top to bottom, I don't know anybody. John Mulaney nailed it.
I wish he'd been given more to do.
Well, I mean, look, that can be something that can... Because at this point, we all know there'll be some sort of a sequel. Now, how it will work, I don't know. To shift gears a little bit, they didn't direct the movie, but obviously Chris Miller and Phil Lord played a huge part in shepherding this movie from, you know, conception to final product. And it's not quite to the level of, like, the Lego movie, but it does reek of their sensibility, right? Like, you can just... It doesn't take much to see that they were very much involved in the tone and the way the jokes landed and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think the creativity with it and the willing to test some different boundaries with things. Definitely, I think a Lego kind of movie sensibility is kind of right spot on. You know, each of the different Spider-Verse characters had their own animation style. The really cool features that almost every review and podcast that's broken this movie down, we might as well repeat them. Just, you know, the use of thought bubbles and kind of the word boxes that you see in comics, that pointillism, that's kind of like the old printed page, kind of all those little dots together. I mean, it just their way of pushing that was so much of what made the movie, and it wasn't just kind of a look, we can do this sort of thing. It really felt integral to the story they were trying to tell. It wasn't superfluous. It seemed to have a purpose and a place, and that's what I really appreciated and enjoyed about it.
I also really loved the way they did the origin stories.
Yeah.
They said, now, one more time. Now, that's not something you can do multiple movies. I mean, that kind of will wear thin over time, the same way that origin stories now have worn thin. But for this movie, perfect.
Well, that's, I agree.
My question about Chris Miller and Phil, the reason I bring them up, is does this movie vindicate them from being fired for Solo? I think so, right? I mean, in essence, they're the winners of that little battle, because Solo came and went, and it was a dud. And well, this movie is an absolute smash.
Definitely they can look and go scoreboard.
Yeah.
In some ways. I mean, that might get us too much into a tangent about, you know, expectations for Star Wars movies. Solo made still a buttload of money.
Sure, but I'm just saying, I think they'll be vindicated right now.
It's a little harsh, I think.
Sure, but right now the public wants what they're selling.
No, I do agree with that. And I want to say one other thing about the origin stories. I mean, you're right, it was perfect. And to me, it's another example of that. It didn't feel superfluous. It didn't feel tacked on as so many superhero origins kind of do, especially with our better-known characters at this point.
Well, and one thing it did, and I don't know if this was the original intent or they just stumbled upon this, because it could have been one of those things that they started it one direction, and then by the end, they're like, what if we did, oh my gosh, that'd be perfect. When you get to the end and Miles says, one more time, from the beginning, like that crescendos to that point.
Right. They made it more than just exposition.
Yes,
they made it a major
plot
point.
Like,
they made
and it was sort of like the moment that he crossed over and became Spider-Man, you know, and it also sort of connected all of their origins in a way that maybe wouldn't have been hammered home as succinctly had they just done them in another way.
Yeah, I mean, it was the emotional pivot point of the entire movie. You know, it was the climax really of that part of the story. And the other thing that's really cool too, that you might not pick up on, is that every time they threw at the end of that, they threw the cover, like that was an actual rendering of a comic
of a cover. Yeah,
like
of a comic
the first
cover.
Appearance of Miles, like that's his cover. That's
and,
pretty cool.
Which is cool that they can do that stuff.
Yeah.
And also the Stan Lee cameo benefited immensely from coming right after his death.
That was
would have landed anyhow. But I think as fortune would have it for the movie, because it came so close to his death, it landed in a way that no one would have anticipated when they filmed it 2 or 3, 4 years ago.
Right. It was already the best cameo Stan did, because it's A, kind of funny,
and it
wasn't superfluous. Nothing in this movie was superfluous.
I mean, it's what it feels like.
Yeah, it was authentic and needed, moved the story along. More than just a, hey, there's Stan kind of way.
Okay, now let's talk about one of my favorite scenes from the movie, which is not actually in the movie, but in the post-credit scenes, just as far as just like sheer just joy and brilliance, and definitely felt more of the anarchy and chaos that the Chris Miller and Phil Lord bring to things. But they took the Spider-Verse meme that has been ubiquitous for several years and just ran with it. And totally, like, owned it. And it was, you know, a part of me, if they make a sequel, I want to see the Spider-Man from that cartoon somehow be involved in the movie. because I want to be, you know, I want an opportunity. And I also, if they make a sequel, I desperately want Tobey Maguire to be involved.
That would be amazing.
If they can get him, Andrew Garfield involved.
That would be amazing.
I mean, I think it would be a perfect way to sort of, like, you know, nod to these guys and say, and even, damn, get Tom Holland involved. Get all of them. You know, get all of them to have some sort of small role, even if it's not as a Spider-Man.
Right.
I think it would just be, it would go to speak, you know, and it would in some ways take the potential negative of confusion of having four or five different people play Spider-Man and turn it into a real positive.
Right. To your point about the kind of cachet that Lord and Miller have right now, to me, a great example supporting that argument is they got Oscar Isaacs to do an in-credits scene that was there really just for humor, and they got him to do that, and I think that's amazing. The other thing I think we need to mention also is just the music in that film thought was so much a part of the story. As well, and I just thought it was really well done, and really really pitch perfect. So I just wanted to mention that. Now I've got some rapid fire thoughts for you, because I was just blown away by this movie. From your reaction, I think you were too. This feels like a movie that could make an instant impact also in your rankings. So some rapid fire rankings questions before we get into our top five. Where does Spider-Man and the Spider-Verse rank among all the Spider-Man movies? The three Tobey Maguires, the two Garfields, the one Tom Holland, and this.
Right now, I have it as the second best Spider-Man movie of all time.
The second best. So I'm going to guess behind Spider-Man 2 with Tobey Maguire.
See, that's where you're wrong. I have Spider-Man Homecoming above it.
Okay, all right. So, all right, sandwich in there. That's an acceptable-ish ranking.
Spider-Man 2 is third. And then, you know, we go down the list.
All right, so where is it?
Spider-Man 3 is not the bottom of the barrel.
That's a discussion for another time. Where does it rank among your Marvel movies? Top 10, top 8, top 5? Where would it be kind of in that general neighborhood?
I have a list of Marvel movies, and it's probably right around top 10. I don't know. You know, I'd have to go through it more. But that's my gut feeling, that it's right around top 10.
Okay, and then just kind of animated movies in general. You know, is this one that you feel like would be, again, kind of a top 25?
Now, when you talk about anime movies in general, you've got a much, much, much bigger and deeper, you know, pull from. I will say this, it's in the top 500 of all time, of just movies.
Of just movies in general. Just movies for you in general, it's in the top 500.
Yeah, it's in the top 500.
Wow.
So it's up there, and I would say there may be. I can't imagine that of all the films I've seen that it's not in the top 70. I'd say somewhere between 50 and 100 is where it falls.
Well, Spider-Man Noir might say that's high praise.
Yeah, I mean it's good. it's up there with the second tier. Pixar movies. I don't think it's up there with the first tier to me, but it's up there with the second tier, borderline first tier of the best they've done.
I think it's pretty obvious this was a wonderful choice for one of your final 10 movies.
Oh, it's a great movie.
And so we will move then into now the top five. You mentioned animated movies is kind of a very wide genre, and so what better pool then to dive into to think about top five animated voiceover performances. Give us your number five on that list.
Number five, I'm going to say, is, and this is just pulling it, you know, throwing it together. If I had thought it out and had more time, it might come, I'd be different. But for right now, I'm going to say top five, number five, Tom Hanks is Woody.
Toy Story 4 is set to come out.
And I'm cautiously super excited. But I don't know. It's gonna be weird because it feels like this movie, Toy Story 4, has had a bit of a tortured production because the story Rashida Jones and her writing partner got shelved because she had issues with John Lasseter's creepiness. I mean, that really is, right. I think, boiled over into it. So it sort of feels like, I don't know, and this will be the first big test of can Pixar sort of move forward without his guiding vision. And they should, obviously, because if he was creating that sort of a hostile environment, but then, you know, can they survive in that way without his idea? I don't know. We'll see. So it'll be an interesting move. But I am cautiously optimistic.
Right. Number four.
Number four is James Earl Jones from The Lion King as Mufasa.
Ooh, say it again.
As Mufasa.
Ooh, say it again. I love that
they got him to come back for the quote unquote live action, which I've seen people, and I tend to agree with them, if the movie is all CGI, is it live action? I mean, isn't it just like animated in a different way?
Pretty much.
I mean, it looks good. I will say my minor quibble with the voice cast is I love Seth Rogen as Pumbaa, right?
Right.
Love it. But I feel like if you're going to get Seth Rogen to be Pumbaa, not getting James Franco to be Timon is missing the boat.
I would tend to agree with that.
I like Billy Eichner okay in doses, but I'm not sure he's Timon material.
Yeah.
To recast Timon and Pumbaa as two, like, stoners seems funny to me, but okay.
So number three, would it be Nathan Lane as Timon or somebody else?
I'm gonna try to get away from doing, you know, staying in the same movie category, and I got lots of good people to choose from, but number three, I'm gonna go with the Ellen DeGeneres' Dory.
Oh yeah, that's a good performance. I feel like that was kind of part of her comeback, kind of feel.
It was part of her transformation into beloved icon.
Yeah, right. I'm a natural blue.
Yeah. I mean, she, you know, and which I did. Speaking of Ellen DeGeneres, recently, within the past month or so, I rewatched EdTV, which I'd forgotten she was in.
Right.
And so she had like this interesting sort of like career. You know, she was in some sort of romantic comedy, which now. Almost to think of it now is laughable because, you know, we know so much more about Ellen where that becomes harder and harder to see her in that role. You know, so she had this sort of like movie burgeoning career and then it sort of bottomed out after the coming out because they're like, yay, good for you. Now we don't know what to do with you.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. So, Dory, an iconic performance.
And it's, yeah. And you can't imagine anyone else in the role, right?
No, you can't. No, yeah, that's. I definitely think that's definitely top five worthy. What's your number two?
Okay, number two is a voice that I think is perfectly matched for the character, even though it's not the biggest character in the series. But this is Don Rickles as Mr. Potato Head. I mean, he is Mr. Right?
Yes.
Like, is that not like? Can you imagine anyone else?
That's really good.
Like now, when you see a Mr. Potato Head, really you good. Hear Don Rickles,
that's
right?
Really, yeah. No, definitely. Yeah, that's really good. I love that. And I love you throwing some appreciation towards someone who's a little older and a living legend even before he donned the living legend of Mr. Potato Head.
And I thought about, you know, some other people that I thought about that couldn't quite make the list. Billy Crystal as Mike Wazowski, perfect, mm-hmm. of course. Mm-hmm. And one that I thought was a little off the beaten path, but I think when you think about it, you realize yes, it's a good. But he didn't make the list either. But it's Andy Serkis as Gollum.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
I mean, that's we don't think of it as being a voiceover performance because it's really more motion. But I mean, that movie doesn't work if that character doesn't work.
Right. No. Definitely.
But number one though.
Number one is
just this movie, perfect fit for his character and just sort of for his sort of brand. Of comedy and just sort of free spiritedness, and this is Robin Williams as the genie.
If you had said anything else as number one, we would have ended this podcast on this episode and would not have recorded seven more episodes to get to 10,000 because we wouldn't have talked.
It's just an
again.
Explosion of creativity, right?
Yeah, no, it's that's without a doubt, I think the best.
I wanted to include Eddie Murphy as Donkey because I think that sort of revitalized his career late stage. There's so many people that I could have thought of, but that to me is like probably at the end of the day one of, if not the most enduring Robin Williams performances, because it feels like it's the closest to like inside his head.
And I'm still mad that he didn't get nominated for Best Actor for that performance.
or some sort. And it still, you know, and it makes you wonder too, like, have you, you know, the fresh hype about the new Aladdin remake, which, you know, that's another story, but it only makes you appreciate more the genius that we got to experience with Robin.
Yeah. I agree. That's the best voiceover performance I would have picked as well. So, well, once again, friends, we've come time to close out this episode of the Quest for 10,000. Thank you again for downloading, listening, sharing this with someone else to listen to. Find us on Twitter at 10K Movies or on Brian's blog, 10kmovies.com. We'll be back. Our next episode is going to be probably a bit after Groundhog Day. And so in a way to continue the tradition we've also developed on the podcast to talk about Brian's number one movie, it will be kind of our last look at Groundhog Day. And we'll probably also take a look at a particular documentary now available on Netflix about Bill Murray's stories. Until then, we hope your week is a 10.
10 plus.
Borderline 11.